Back to newspapers today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Shane Brown writes a purely personal column for the Dispatch Argus. We'll meet him today on Scribble. Shane, how did you ever fall into this gig, or did you have to fight your way into it?
Honestly, it was all kind of random. I started at the Dispatch in the advertising department, where I still am to this day. I work in the classified department, so if you call in to place a garage sale ad, there's a pretty good chance you're going to talk to me or help wanted. But gosh, for years, you know, every day we'd get a newspaper sitting on our desk, and I'd take a look at the columnists that we had and enjoy their stuff and read Dave Barry every week, and then I was like, you know what, I think I could do that. Gave it a shot, submitted a few sample columns, and they finally gave me a chance. So
you just pestered them, huh?
Yeah.
Well, my question whenever I read your column is, how do they let you get away with it? you are the counterculture Argus.
it does happen from time to time.
It really is. I mean, you can really see why everything else fits in the Argus. And then, whoa, in comes Shane Brown.
I have been told that I set a precedent because I am the only writer there allowed to use the word suck.
You have that in writing?
Yeah, no, not in writing, but I've been told.
Be careful. There may be something written somewhere you don't know about. But how do you do it? How do you, writing a column once a week, I can tell you from my own experience, is a chore. But mine is more of a chore because I've got to write about something. It seems as if your life is spread out there in the newspaper.
As best I can. You know, this is, when I first started, boy, column ideas came fast and hard. You know, I was writing them 3-4 weeks in advance sometimes. And, you know, now I'm very close to my 700th column. I've been counting them all. Wow. And, you know, by this point, it gets a little challenging sometimes. There are weeks where I'm free to admit I have absolutely no idea what I'm going to write about until I open the computer and stare at a blank notepad page and go, uh-oh.
Well, it must sort of mess up your life to realize that somewhere I better get a column. And
oh yeah,
you know, when I went to South America in the South American term, I very quickly learned to take the first student whose camera was stolen and give them my camera and say, I want a copy of every picture you take. And then I didn't have to worry. I could actually see South America instead of, how am I going to frame this? How am I going to do this? Doesn't that really mess up your life?
Yep. There are weeks when I'm like, boy, I sure hope something interesting or funny happens to me as I go about my daily business.
I know, but then you have to go
and
look for something interesting. And
yeah, but conversely, it can be a fantastic thing because I could be having one of the worst days of my life and there's still a voice in the back of my head saying, well, if nothing else, this is going to make a fantastic column.
Isn't it true? I know in the Genesius Guild, we'd have a disaster, and then later on, it would be the subject of comedy forever. We'd laugh about it, and I remember once when I was trying to get the cast to shape up, says, do you want to be one of the incidents we talk about in the future? One of the actors says, that was the most terrifying thing anyone's ever threatened me with.
Absolutely. It's just earlier this week, I'm the world's worst cook. And earlier this week, I set about making a ham steak, which is probably one of the simplest things that you can do in a kitchen.
How do you ham steak?
Yet I destroyed it. I wrecked the thing. And all I could do was laugh and go, oh, this is going to be great in print. So that's going to be my column next Monday. You're all going to learn about the horror of the ham steak.
But that, how do I know you didn't do this deliberately? But that's that is interesting because, you know, everyone's life falls into a pattern. And your life, you know, although your mind obviously is more agile than most, but, but still, days pretty much get the same. How can you mind that?
Yeah, or something to write about. Sometimes it does become a challenge. You know, I'm blessed, though, to have multiple jobs. You know, not only do I do the column, but I'm at the paper every day. But I also DJ on the weekends and MC trivia nights. And I try to keep myself as busy as possible. And, you know, the nice thing about that is that column topics sometimes tend to just fall directly into my lap, so.
Well, you know, and when you write about being a DJ, I think, yeah, this is countercultural for the Dispatch Argus. This is really different. And that is a different life. How popular is that venue? You hear about DJs, you know, being employed at parties and events. And to me, years ago, I thought, are you kidding? is that what you do at parties now? And apparently that is very much the thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm nowhere near as big as any of the guys on a national scale, but, you know, you get these big name EDM DJs nowadays like Tiesto and Calvin Harris, and they can command $1 million per gig to play at a festival. And they're just standing on a stage playing other people's records for 2 hours, probably making more than the artists did to cut the music.
That's amazing. Is there much of a demand for that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think there always is. Thankfully, there will always be a desire for people to go out and have fun on the weekends, and they need a good soundtrack to do it, you know. And
well, I suppose it used to be you'd hire a little band of some kind.
Yeah, yeah.
But that gets pretty expensive.
Yeah, yeah, it sure can. It sure can. And, you know, with me, it's just kind of a plug-and-play setup. I've got my own gear and just show up and plug into the club system, and away you go, five-minute setup.
Mm-hmm. When you sit down to write, Shane, do you imagine an audience, a reader? Or
sometimes, but a lot of times I'm honestly just writing for myself. Rather than envisioning someone actually reading the column, I'll just come up with, well, boy, this kind of makes me laugh. I hope it makes other people laugh.
But the imagined audience might be somebody like you.
Yeah, yeah, it could be.
And I dare say you are not the typical Argus reader.
That could be.
But it is fascinating, the whole business of writing a personal column. That can veer into almost anything you want to talk about.
Yeah, which is kind of nice that I don't have, you know, they've never put any kind of constraints on me. You know, I stay away from hard news topics, stay away from politics because there's other people who are far more skilled and gifted and trained in talking about that kind of stuff than I am. But otherwise, they've never told me a thing that I can or can't write about, which is kind of a blessing. So,
but surely you have a self-censor. Almost every writer does.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. I don't want to do anything that's going to inadvertently upset people or tick people off or rub anybody the wrong way with a bad joke or, you know. I've had a couple columns backfire on me over the years, and it's not fun to deal with reader complaints.
Do you get a lot of feedback from readers?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, quite a bit. Quite a bit. You know, it's thrilling, honestly, to be, you know, stopped in the grocery store by somebody who says, oh, my gosh, I like your columns. And it's almost just as thrilling to get, you know, an email from somebody saying, I hated what you wrote this week. You know, it's like, my God, I still can't get over the fact that people take any time out of their lives to listen to my drivel every Monday. You know, it's kind of neat.
I think what people, particularly those who don't like what you have written, what they don't realize is if they write a letter to the editor or an email – even if it's negative, that counts for you. It means somebody read it.
Exactly.
And that's all the editors look at. If somebody's reading this, so they don't like it, well, that's life.
But, and that's what I heard one, you know, there was the big chicken controversy of 2 years ago. I don't know if you guys read any of that at that time. But I wrote a very ill-timed column about urban chickens in Rock Island. And it was the big battle at the time whether the city council was going to allow folks to have chickens in their backyard. And well, I had actually – it started with with me having a week where I had absolutely no idea what to write about, to the point that I put it out on Facebook. I'm like, I wrote to all of my Facebook friends. I'm like, anybody has any good column ideas, let me know. And one of my friends immediately shot back, oh, you should talk about urban chickens. And I'm like, well, yeah, maybe I should, but I have a feeling you might not like what I have to say about it. As a general rule, I'm not a fan of nature. I run from nature. I'm an indoor person. And so I wrote a kind of a tongue-in-cheek column about how I don't understand how anybody would want chickens in their backyard, and I'm not a favor of it, and feathers and allergies and the circle of life. These are things I don't want to see in my neighborhood. And boy, I thought it was a cutesy column, but boy, the urban chicken proponents were not a fan. And I didn't know that they were motivated. I didn't know that they had a Facebook group and a national group.
I think it's a way of life, right?
Yeah,
I
mean, yeah. And so next thing I know, they were sharing my article on a local group, and then it went to a national group, and I was getting dozens and dozens of letters, and the paper was fielding folks with pitchforks with one in my head on a stick, and it was – I was like, oh, I really didn't intend for this to go this bad. And I was honestly scared for a while. You know, I went up to my editor, and I'm like, I'm really, really sorry that I opened this can of worms. And they're like, we love
it. Well, I'm sure. I mean, look at the publicity the Argus got out of that.
That's true. And that's why I say negative response is actually a positive.
Yeah, well, kind of. I mean, by the time the chicken thing was all said and done, people had figured out my address, and I came home from work to find my house egged and
oh, really?
Chicken poop on my back steps.
I better look that column up again, Spain.
Well, I remember the chicken controversy, yeah.
But the best part was when I came home a few days later and there was a package on my back steps, and I'm like, I'm going to open it up and there's going to be a dead chicken in this, isn't there? It's going to be real, real, real bad. So I did. I opened it very carefully outside my house, not knowing what it was, and opened it up, and it ended up being an entire case of freeze-dried bacon from my friends at Ross's Family Restaurant with a note saying, Team Bacon for the win.
It's odd how you can take the simplest thing and write about it, make a story. When I was doing TV documentaries, somebody was talking about, you know, you run out of ideas. I said, well, I could dig up a square foot of soil, and there'd be enough in there to talk about, you know, that you could do a good hour documentary just on that. Because any subject can be, you can dig into almost anything and go at great length and great depth.
It amazes me. My fellow columnist, John Marks, who's, you know, a fantastic writer and has been at the Dispatch for years, he does generally about once a week or once every other week, he'll do a column that just says, to the best of my knowledge, and then he'll bullet point out like a dozen little clips. And I will read that every week and go, my God, I could mine a column out of every single one of these.
Yeah,
it's just like the ideas that he's throwing into the wind. I'm just like, oh, I could get 1,000 words on this and that and the other.
You know, Cezanne, I think, who said I could paint my entire life just by turning from left to right.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. It's there is so much detail. I talked to the point of tedium about my fascination with trees. I just can't stop looking at them and marveling at them. And every time I see them, I think that's what I see, the root system underneath. I have an oak tree next door that I'm sure its roots go down 3 or 4 houses underneath.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you look at something in detail, all of a sudden the world opens up in ways that you don't expect. And every answer you get is simply a set of questions. And you can go on and on and on. But the problem is picking. The problem is picking what to talk about. And you don't seem to have had much of a problem, Shane.
You'd be surprised sometimes, but
has doing your program changed you in any way, your attitude toward life or human nature or view of who you are or where you fit into the scheme of things?
Probably not of who I am. You know, a lot of it, I think, I was blessed. My parents are the most amazing parents in the world, and I'll fight anybody to the death who declares their parents better than mine. But that said, I'll freely admit I was a little coddled as a kid. Like, when I got up to college, I had no idea what I was doing. Right. I'd never washed a dish in my life. I'd never done a load of laundry in my life. So sometimes the most mundane aspects of life are still a little magical to me.
Like ham steak.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, and that, I suppose, that accounts for your fascination with what is in front of you. But, you know, have you ever thought of trying to organize all this into a book?
Always. Always. I'm constantly thinking, I could write a book. I could write a – you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with a little bit of healthy envy. I will read a book – and I'll love it. And then 5 minutes later, there'll be a voice band that says, well, I could do that.
Well, you know, a lot of books have begun that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So are you going to?
Yes. Yes, I will say yes, I am. I have no definitive plans as of yet, but it will happen.
We have a recording of this.
Yep.
We can play back.
Yep.
Do you blog along with a lot of people of your generation?
I do a little bit. I wish I had time to do my blog more often and anymore.
Is it the same kind of stuff that goes into your column?
Yeah, yep. And it is a repository of my columns. I duplicate it online.
Okay.
And, you know, before I had my column, I kind of started a music blog on my own where, you know, me and a bunch of friends would get on and talk about music and bands and things like that. And that got me into blogging way before the column.
Well, Tweet, step up now and you tell this gentleman how he is to proceed to organize his material into a book.
I think there's a right way for every person, and it's different. You know, the reason there are so many freshman English texts is that somebody, you know, out in Podunk U has a successful freshman English class and says, I'm going to write a book because I know how to do it. And then at Augustana College, we buy the book. We say, boy, this sounds good. And it doesn't work for us, right?
Mm-hmm.
A Crime and Punishment is written in 13 days to pay off a gambling debt. Not a bad book, right? But that's not the way to write a book. I think we were talking in a previous program about Jesuit priests as teachers. We had a Jesuit priest who had retired from the priesthood, and he taught at Augie for 3 years, and what he taught was freshman English. And he had boiled down all the 300 rules of teaching that you see at the end of every freshman text, awkward, transition, etc., into two sentences. See what's there. Sentence two, tell the truth.
See what's there and tell the truth.
Yeah. What else is there, right?
What is truth?
Well, ask Shane.
That is the question.
Yes.
Because you see what's there, and the way you see it may not be the way it actually is.
But you can't. You have no other choice but to see it the way you see it, right? Mm-hmm.
So
I mean, we are each trapped in our own observations, our own time, our own personalities.
But I guess what I would
ask pretend,
you, should he look for a theme running through? Should he group certain columns together? How could he take this raw material of his columns, and how should he deal with it?
Poetry books are usually divided into themes, you know, five parts. But most of the recent essay books that I read are not.
Yeah, please don't ask me to write poetry. It wouldn't be pretty.
Right? Well, same here.
But
there's a column for you there,
yep,
Shane.
Yep.
Why can't I write poetry, huh?
Right. I have a distinct memory of pacing up and down the slough path at Augustana in 1990 trying to come up with ideas for your creative writing class.
So that well-worn path is your responsibility.
Yep.
Well, Shane, don't give it up because, Tweet will never get off your back. Everybody to write a book. Shane Brown, who writes a highly personal column in the Dispatch Argus, and we'll wait to see what happens next.
Every Monday, hint, it may involve ham steak.
It may involve ham steak. Just leave us out of this. Thanks again. Thank you very much, Shane Brown.
Thanks.
I wonder how we would fare, Roel, if we had to write a column about what's happening to us every day.
More of the same. I don't even look at, several times when I was in high school, I tried to keep a diary. And, it would, you know, by the day five, it would be today is Thursday.
I was surprised to discover that people expected me to keep a journal when I was in Springfield and to write a book about it. And when this was brought home to me, I thought, well, maybe I should. So I bought one of those recording things. And when I'd drive home after session, I would dictate into this. And then I'd have my secretary transcribe it.
Well, actually, Don, you have told me enough stories over the past years about events that happened to you that I should have been taking them down, and then I could have published a book edited by me, The Sayings of Don Wooten, because you weren't just a typical senator down there.
I was an oddball, there's no question about it.
And you are full of stories about it, so you certainly could have done a book. You still could do a book.
Yeah, but when I read those transcriptions, I thought, this is the tallest stuff I've ever seen.
After the history of the Genesius Guild, which needs to be written.
You know, actually, I have this little outfit called Dragon. My son Steve gave it to me, 3 years ago? Put it on the thing, and then you can dictate, and the words appear on the screen.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding. And I recently uncovered that, and I thought, maybe when Steve is here, I'll have him attach this and try, give it a shot. Because as you can tell, I can talk forever, but writing, I don't know. That's too much of a chore. But I like to read, and I must say, this is an odd book. It's called Underbug.
I've heard about it.
An Obsessive Tale of Termites and Technology by Lisa Marganelli. She's a senior research fellow at New American Foundation, and she gets interested in things. She wrote a wonderful book in 2007, Oil on the Brain, Petroleum's Long, Strange Trip to Your Tank. And she has recorded a TED Talk on this, The Political Chemistry of Oil, which you can find, pardon me, on the Internet. But this one about termites, first of all, you ask someone what a termite is, and they'll tell you this is white ant that eats wood. No, it's a cockroach. It's related to the cockroach.
It doesn't look like one.
No, it looks like an ant with a swelled head. But they do things that are just fascinating. They build what would be to them skyscrapers that are air-conditioned, and what they have found as they've studied termites, they figure like ants, you can figure out the society. You know, this is the queen, people are assigned this and that. Termites are not like that. Termites sometimes decide, I don't want to work.
Well, I got really hooked as a kid on bees and ants as social insects and how the hive works and everybody's got a job and everybody knows what the job is. But how do termites do it without – there's no social order in a termite?
No. They have jobs to do and they seem to do it automatically, but scientists can't figure out how. But they do – boy, they are persistent pests. termites got into an Indian bank and ate $220,000 in banknotes. I mean, there's a pest. There's something you don't want around. And I know I invested in a house that was just overrun with termites. And when you see the damage they can do, it's impressive. But she has written, there are all kinds of the mind in the mound, a tale of termites and tech, how termites run the world, the gold and termite guts. Termites have bacteria in their guts, and those bacteria have bacteria. And how all that works to persuade the termite to do whatever in the heck it is it's going to do is just fascinating. And scientists are working on it like crazy.
I think we have more questions about all aspects of nature now than we ever did before. Well, you know, I thought by now we would have answered them all.
Well, the one thing I discovered in dealing with science is that the answer to the question you've asked is another series of questions. And termites just produce more and more questions about how do they operate and what exactly, how do you classify them? They are not organized the way bees and ants are. They have an organization, obviously, that gets things done, but they are interesting creatures. And surprisingly diverse.
So, do they have a queen in a hive?
Yeah, they operate on that same reproductive system. But all I can say is, if you want to be amazed, read Underbug by Lisa Marganelli, An Obsessive Tale of Termites and Technology. The thing is, you would think, why would I want to read about termites? Why would I want to read a science book? Science can be kind of deadly, dull, and so on. But she's funny. She's not only humorous, she not only has a good attitude toward this, but she is very precise in her writing, and it's easy to follow. And she has trekked around the globe following scientists who are working on termites. And along the way, she tells you something about them, and it's really a very chatty kind of an informative book. Underbug by Lisa Marganelli. We got a minute. You have a minute's worth of recommendations?
Yeah, Carla Miley gave me a sequel to a book that 2 years ago was all the rage. That book was called The 100-Year-Old Man Who Climbed Out the Window and Disappeared.
Oh, yeah.
And it turned out, went all over Sweden in a yellow bus with an elephant inside, eluding police. Well, you think it can't get any better, but here's the new sequel, Further Misadventures of the 101-Year-Old Man by Jonas Jonasson. This time, the 101-Year-Old Man gets lost in a balloon in the Indian Ocean, is picked up by a North Korean ship shipping uranium to North Korea, meets Kim Jong-un, and comes to the United States, meets Trump, meets Steve Bannon, and becomes really good friends with Angela Merkel. you can't believe it.
No, I can't. But what's the name of it?
Further Misadventures of the 101-Year-Old Man. It's worth reading.
Okay, well, there are two odd books for you for today. Maybe we'll have some more conventional next week. Till then, I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Thanks for tuning in, Scribble. We'll see you next time.